dying of laughter.
It's not funny.
My mom has stage 4 cancer in her bones and in her breast. My dad's disease was 15 years, he died of ALS. I made a podcast about death, seemed like the thing to do. And if you're sad by all this,
well,
you're gonna die too.
Okay, I'm super excited today as we are chatting with an internal medicine doctor based in the Southeast. We're going to keep some of the details confidential for his privacy, and we are really looking forward to speaking with him and learning more about what's going on in the medical community. So thank you so much for giving the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here.
So for those who don't know, if you don't mind sharing a little bit about your experience as an internal medicine doctor and how COVID-19 has impacted your day-to-day.
Yeah, absolutely. I know a lot of times when you throw out the term internal medicine, you either kind of know what it is or you don't. Basically, we are the kind of physicians that take care of pretty much all the organ systems of the body. The main things that we don't deal with are sort of psychiatry, OB-GYN type issues, or surgery. But if you have kidneys, lungs, intestines, and a heart, you'll probably be working with us in some capacity anytime you sort of come into contact with a hospital or even in the primary care setting. So being that that's the case, we actually see a lot of patients with COVID because most of them do present with upper respiratory type symptoms, and we are going to be the primary provider of care for them when they do come into the hospital from day one until ideally discharge.
I remember speaking with you about a little bit of your experiences a few weeks ago, and it sounds like what you're doing in your day-to-day is impacted greatly. And so, A, thank you for going to work, and B, for people who have no idea what that is like, what has the experience been like interacting with COVID patients in the medical communities, and how has your hospital adjusted to these new times?
So, things have been a little hectic around these parts, obviously, with a lot of the economy sort of shut down and the hospital having to stay open for very obvious reasons. And so our hospital system has adjusted very well. We've made a lot of changes to the way that we screen patients. We've closed off entire sections of the hospital to be basically proofed and sealed in negative pressure type areas to facilitate sort of placing patients with COVID in rooms where they wouldn't be at such high risk of contaminating others or coming in contact with other patients. Then we can allow us to sort of create dedicated COVID teams where we have specialized physicians that are very comfortable dealing with the patient population as well as emergency physicians that can sort of triage and take care of that specific patient population without risking sort of spreading. You know, you can imagine if me as a physician, if I'm taking care of five patients without COVID and two patients with, anytime I go in and out of a room, I'm at risk for sort of contaminating, let's say, you know, part of my shirt or my scrubs or something. If I go into another patient's room, that's a risk of what's called nosocomial or hospital spread. So we've sectioned off entire ICUs to just take care of patients with COVID, and we've sort of made a lot of adjustments there. I think the big thing that you see kind of all over the news are issues with PPE. Fortunately, so PPE is personal protective equipment. Mm-hmm. Basically, they're the masks, surgical masks, which are just kind of like cloth that cover your face, as well as the N95s, which are called that because they actually filter out 95% of particles that you're breathing through the mask. Basically, just kind of get caught on the outside of the mask through the filter. In addition to that, it includes face shields, things like surgical hats or hairnets, as well as disposable gowns and gloves. And the idea with PPE is that you are supposed to put it on when you enter a patient's room, and then ideally all of it gets thrown away right as you exit the patient's room. Therefore, anything that you touch doesn't get cross-contaminated if you were to leave the room and start going into another patient's room or utilizing any equipment outside of the room, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a measure to both keep the patient safe from cross-contamination as well as to keep yourself safe and mitigate your own risk of exposure. A lot of issues I think that people see if they watch the news are obviously there's a shortage of PPE. A lot of that is driven by the fact that it's very difficult to obtain good and accurate testing in a large enough supply. And so anytime a patient you think may even possibly have COVID, you're obviously going to have to wear PPE to enter that room. And so if you have, you know, 100 patients and maybe only 3 of them have COVID, but 90 of them you think may have COVID, that means you're using PPE for 90 of those patients when maybe you only needed it for 3. But because we can't test, it makes it unfortunately very difficult to justify not using PPE in those rooms.
Wow. Yeah, definitely. That, I mean, it sounds very challenging for a lot of reasons. Is there something that you would say has been the most challenging or most difficult so far? And then is there one thing that has been surprisingly more positive or easier than you thought?
Yeah, I think I'll answer that first part. I guess in terms of things that are more challenging, the face of COVID is just a strange disease in that, you know, it behaves a lot like some just typical flu-like pathogens in some patients, but it can be just devastating in terms of what it does to not only the lungs, but the entire human body in another patient. And while we, you know, have things that we can base that upon, like, you know, patients that are older, have a lot of medical problems that they've been dealing with for a long time, tend to be sicker, and we kind of expect that. We also see the other end of things where, you know, a perfectly healthy young person with no medical problems is suddenly finding themselves on life support within just a couple of days of finding the illness. And I think the unique challenges between that and knowing that, you know, unlike the flu, where we can ideally, provide vaccination, and we maybe even have treatment options, there really are no specific medications that we can use to treat this virus. And we don't have a vaccine yet to try to prevent other people who are at risk from catching the virus. And because it's so contagious, when you see pockets like New York, where you get these major, major outbreaks, and it's just so hard to sort of stop the spread and deal with the aftermath after it picks up and hits a sort of critical mass. And so I think both from an epidemiologic standpoint, it's very challenging to see just how much this has devastated people's lives, people's livelihoods, the economy, but more specifically, the individual with the disease burden and what that does to their families. There are places in this country right now where to minimize exposure risk, people can't even physically enter the hospital to see their loved ones, even at the time where they may be passing away. I can only imagine how heartbreaking and difficult that must be for certain people to have to deal with that.
Yeah, so for those people in that situation, is there someone at the hospital that is trained in having those conversations? I know sometimes there's outside groups that come in. I'm just curious, as someone who volunteers in the grief space, if there's been any kind of process like that.
Yeah, I mean, so all of us in medicine are trained to have these sort of difficult conversations, but a lot of it is much more art than a skill that can necessarily be taught. I think if anybody has ever interacted with a physician, you probably realize that there are some people that are really great at expressing those feelings and finding a way to comfort people. And there are others that unfortunately just are not as good at doing that sort of thing. Fortunately, you know, we have resources through the hospital with both grief counselors, chaplains, as well as members from the psychiatry service, who have a lot of times offered their assistance to help speak with families and comfort grieving people in that sort of time of need.
That's great. Well, yeah, I'm glad to hear that. I'm sure it's depends on the need and depends on how many people are available to do things like that. But it's good to know that some things do exist. What would you say to the general public about the current state of gloves and masks? We all know we're supposed to have gloves and masks depending where you are. It's required in many places. Is there anything else that you would say is helpful? And between the gloves and the mask, do you think wearing both is equally as important, or is one more important than the other?
Yeah, so this is an area where obviously I'm going to kind of defer to the CDC and their expertise here, which I think their official recommendation is it's probably a good idea to wear a mask If you are in an area with sort of a high prevalence of disease, and if you're at a higher risk of coming into contact with people who have the virus, I think one of the biggest pieces of advice that I could give to people is if you are going to choose to wear a mask, if you are going to choose to wear gloves, please be conscientious in the way that you do so. Because I think anybody that just kind of surfs the internet can find a few, more than a few instances of people who are not wearing them in the right way. I think a quick search on just how to properly apply the mask, how to take it off, how to use gloves in the right scenario can be very beneficial. Because the idea of wearing a mask is not necessarily to protect you per se. It's more so for people who are symptomatic. If they're going to cough out, it's going to deflect some of the currents, and then maybe they won't cough out virus particles, you know, a full 20 feet away from them, because there's a physical barrier in the way. Because remember, the virus itself is small enough to get through even an N95, which filters out, you know, like I said, 95% of particles that get through. And so the idea is just to minimize, again, how far things spread. So N95 are designed to be worn in such a way to guarantee that you have a tight seal around your face. And so you not only need to make sure that you have the right size, but you also need to make sure that you don't have facial hair underneath so that you can actually guarantee that it will sit and rest and properly fit your face. The other thing is, if you have gloves, please don't start touching things like your phone or putting your hands in your pockets while you're wearing gloves, because all you're doing is taking the germs that hit the glove and putting them on surfaces that you will then later come into contact with once you've removed the glove. So the idea is, if you're going to go, you know, grocery shopping or something, you can put the gloves on, do your shopping, be sure not to touch anything other than food or your cart, and then once you're done grocery shopping, take off the gloves and please throw them in the garbage. And I will just leave it at that.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. I just realized, this is such a random question. Is this why doctors don't typically have facial hair, or surgeons, because they have to wear masks so often?
Yeah, actually. That's a large part of it.
I've never thought about that before.
And so they actually, on day one, they ask you, you know, be well-groomed, so to speak. And of course, if you have religious exemptions and things like that, there's alternatives such as the PAPRs, which please don't ask me to expressly state what that stands for. But basically those like painter's masks that have like the filters and things that can fully surround and cover your face in order to, if you need to maintain the beard. But yeah, for the most part, it's because if we ever need to utilize those masks, it needs to come directly into contact with skin.
That makes sense. Learning something new every day. And yes, about the gloves, I think throwing them away is very important, because I will say the first few times I wore gloves, I didn't have access to enough. And so I was like, should I wear this same pair again? And a question I would have is, if you don't have access to enough, is it better to wear the same pair twice or to wear only that pair once and then not wear them the second time? Is one better or worse than the other?
So you have to remember that if you wear that mask and you put it on your face, everything that you come into contact with in the outside world, you know, I'm talking about a simple surgical mask here, is going to cover the surface of the outside. And some of it is going to make it to the inside surface of the mask. And so obviously with repetitive uses, you're just building up more stuff that's going to eventually make its way to the inside where you can risk inhaling it. In theory, you can reuse masks. I really would not advise that. They are designed just for one-time uses. And make sure that you're going, if you, when you do take them off from the ear loops or from the ties behind your head. You don't want to grab the actual face of the mask unless you're just going to go immediately wash your hands right after.
Can you wear the same pair of latex gloves twice if you wash them in warm water and soap? And for masks, can you wash the mask in the washing machine and then wear it again? That's fine, right?
Gotcha.
Okay.
So actually, if you get those masks wet, you will pretty much destroy the fibers that make up any sort of filtering mechanism that the mask has. So
is
I'm
that
not talking about like
an N95 though, but cloth masks.
Yeah,
are
so
different.
That's like an N95 okay. Or or like a surgical mask that you can kind of buy, just, you know, like the typical ones that people tend to wear whenever they have like a normal cough and they're just being courteous by wearing like the mask that kind of loop around the ears. Those cannot reuse. But yes, if you have like a bandana or something, you can definitely wash that in detergent, and those cloth ones you can kind of reuse. As far as gloves, so you actually can wash gloves in soap and water. They will be fine, especially if you're using nitrile gloves, which are usually, I think, the standard. But just be careful with that, because anytime you try to take gloves on and off, there's just risk of not, you know, fully making sure you've covered sort of every inch of the glove.
Got it. Okay, that's good to know. I didn't know if I could wash my gloves, and I guess in a perfect world, you just have a million pairs, but if you don't, then washing them is better than others. Okay,
great. Tough to say. I mean, we don't really live in a perfect world, so.
We don't? What's going on? If all we need is a perfect world, and all of our problems will be solved.
I think you're onto something. We should send Trump an email.
Oh, gosh, yeah. What do you think Trump's email address is?
I honestly don't know. I'd like to think, you know, he's caught up with the times. Maybe a Gmail kind of guy, but you know, he seems like the kind of guy that maybe wouldn't want to sleep on Hotmail either. So,
DonaldTrump@whitehouse.gov.
That sounds a little more professional.
But then people might find it's too obvious. So I wonder if it's like a secret redlips@whitehouse.gov. You know, I mean, just something really obscure, or like X106.
Definitely got some kind of alias in there, I would hope.
Thanks for humoring me on that tangent. But back to important things. So right. I think that, you know, a lot of people that listen to this are in entertainment, or they're people grieving the loss of someone close to them. So not necessarily people in the medical community. They could be. Is there one or two things that you really wish the public would know about what's going on that you have found repeatedly patients and people you see do not know?
Tough to say, I guess, in terms of what exactly?
Sorry, you got a little muffled there too. I guess.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, like we talked about the gloves and the mask. I mean, I guess that's the most important thing, but I don't know. I find myself just wishing I knew so much more about this than I do. Is there some kind of practice when people are coming into the hospital that they're surprised by? Maybe not. Maybe the answer is no, but I'm just wondering.
I'm trying to think. I mean, I think the biggest thing that has surprised people are that a lot of hospitals are implementing these sort of, you know, limited to even no visitor policies in some circumstances, which I think is a very, unfortunately, sort of necessary evil in a lot of ways. I think that has taken a lot of people aback and surprised a lot of people in terms of things that they come into the hospital. If there was one thing that I guess I wish people knew or understood, not necessarily virus related, it's just remember that there are a lot of essential workers out there that have to go into their jobs kind of day in and day out and are faced with dealing with this pandemic kind of right there on the front lines, for lack of a better terminology. And I think it's just important to remember that they're all people too. Your doctors and your nurses, your pharmacists, your support staff in the hospital, they're all people too. And there are people that are making a lot of sacrifices, people that are coming into work, coming back home, and can't even make any contact with their family due to fear of putting them at risk and things like that. I mean, it's a very tumultuous and very heavy time for a lot of people working in the field right now. And just to remember that sort of in all of your interactions as you kind of come into contact with healthcare staff in particular.
Thank you for that. Yeah, that's very important. And it's been very fascinating to see how different medical workers handle this. You know, you see in the news, some people are sleeping in their garages, some people, you know, are choosing to interact with their families, and some are not. Do you care to speak to what your experience has been like with friends or family in terms of interaction?
Yeah, I mean, it's been tough. I have not really been able to spend a whole lot of time with friends or family. When I do see my girlfriend, we find a spot outside 6 feet away from each other and have a conversation. And I mean, that's basically what's become our date nights. I can't remember the last time that I've seen my friends in person, outside of obviously seeing coworkers in the hospital and things like that. But it really is a lot of, you know, you wake up, you go into work, you come back home, and then pretty much like everybody else, you know, we're, if we're not watching Netflix or reading papers or working on academic things, trying to sneak in some time to get into the group chat and get on Zoom and things like that. But it's a challenging time. I can't lie and say that it's any easier, just because I do get to physically leave my apartment 6 days a week.
Right. It's like there's pros and cons to both. It's kind of, you know, it's just apples and oranges. There's good things about that you can go to work, and then also challenging things, I'm sure.
I mean, absolutely. Like, you know, it on the one hand, it's nice to be able to say I do get to physically leave my apartment, but I'm physically leaving my apartment and, you know, entering into this whole world of uncertainty, and it's tough, but, you know, that's part of what we signed up for, and it's what we're here to do.
Yes, and thank you. It's so amazing that you're doing it. And I would say, in terms of what you signed up for, it's like, yes, but no. Yes, but did anyone really know that this would happen in their lifetime? And to that point, do you know anyone in the medical community that did feel like they were onto something and thought that this was possible before others did? Or was everyone that you work with kind of just as surprised as the next person?
You know, I think it really just kind of depends who you talk to and who has certain levels of expertise. There's a lot of good papers, if you actually feel like you want to delve into some of the literature on this, that kind of came out and looked at our risks for basically suffering from these viruses that can spread the way that COVID has. A lot of them in the wake of the first SARS epidemic back in the early 2000s. These are what we call zoonotic infections, which means they tend to be transmitted from animals to humans. And so I think a lot of the time since the first SARS epidemic, people were worrying about, well, when is coronavirus just going to develop a new strain, either on its own or through forced repeated exposures, or et cetera, et cetera. And so I think there's a lot of people that are worried about, you know, the big if of when could this happen? What would it look like if it happened? I don't know that anyone was necessarily prepared for it to turn out the way that it did, let alone so rapidly based on how quickly it did. I think we're fortunate in a way that this virus is luckily not as deadly as the first SARS, which I think killed about 10% of people that it came into contact with, compared to about 0.2 to 0.3% of COVID now, or even related to MERS, which was the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, which I believe killed closer to about 30% of people that it came into contact with. So
wow.
I think, you know, this has a profile that's worse than the flu, but certainly manageable. And you can see what it's already doing to our institutions and in terms of equipment like ventilators that we desperately need to take care of these patients, and overwhelming hospital staff and things like that. And I think it's very difficult. And obviously one of the last things that I want to do is talk about the death rate of a virus as if it's just some statistic. I think that's one of the most callous things that you can do when we're talking about human lives. But to look at it through that lens, you know, if we really did nothing at all to prepare for this virus, we would see it infecting pretty much nearly almost everybody within the U.S. and the death toll would be somewhere in the 2 to 3 million if you were looking at some of those earlier projections. And now we're thinking it may be closer to 1 to 200,000. And so from an epidemiological standpoint, we're doing a lot of great things by encouraging people to stay at home and by shutting things down in terms of saving human lives. But obviously that's not a number to sort of sneeze at.
I don't think there's anything that we should sneeze at this point, quite literally. But those numbers are, it's still horrible, but it is nice to think that the social distancing is having some positive effect.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. If you look at our curve and the trajectory that we were on even just 2 weeks ago, I mean, you can actually start to see it flatten. Obviously, one of the things that we worry about in the health professions field is you look to sort of history as an indicator for how things turn out. And if you look at the Spanish flu or the Kansas flu, whatever you want to call it, epidemic from 1918, you can actually look. I think there's an image floating around of the curve in Denver at the time. You can actually see it kind of peaks, and then it starts to dip a couple weeks after sort of stay-at-home and social distancing measures were implemented. And then, unfortunately, you see the restrictions were all lifted almost at once, and it just rebounds and takes more of like an M-shaped curve, with the second peak being even higher than the first. And I think that's what a lot of us fear about, you know, great, we're starting to make some headway, we're starting to actually flatten the curve. But the important thing to remember about flattening the curve is that that just means we're going to maintain a steady level of what we're currently dealing with until things eventually start to come back down. It doesn't mean that we're just going to stay flat and everything is kind of great. It just means we are slowing this thing as best as we possibly can, buying time for either an effective treatment or a vaccine to kind of get us through the other end of the phase. Because ultimately, the only other way that we get around this is enough people are exposed, deal with the illness, and then become immune, that the virus just doesn't physically have enough host to continue to spread itself through. And it either mutates and continues to spread or kind of dies off like other strains of respiratory viruses before it. So right. I think that's a big concern of ours, is to make
you're
sure
a little
that, you
muted
know, athletes,
you're a little
oh I'm sorry
it's okay
so I think that's a big concern of ours, is sort of as we begin to lift these restrictions, to make sure that we're doing it in a responsible way, that we're continuing our social distancing practices, to make sure that we're, you know, staying on top of this and keeping that curve as level as we possibly can.
Do you have any guesses? I don't think there's any enough facts that can accurately predict this at this point, but do you have any educated guesses about to how long you expect social distancing to be as prevalent as it currently is in the United States?
I wish I could predict that. I
tell
would
me everything I need to know, please. Thank you.
I wish that I had the knowledge and the evidence basis and the training in epidemiology that the epidemiologists and the infectious disease doctors have. Unfortunately, I don't. The best that I can do is quote their models, which say, you know, we may be able to ease restrictions on economic things and start to open things back up as soon as this summer. But as far as general, you know, keeping your social distance and keeping your physical distance when interacting in large groups, it's tough to say. I mean, that much of our society and our societal interaction may persist even, you know, a year out from now, just to make sure that we're maintaining things. And there's so many variables that we just don't know. Typical coronaviruses are not particularly heat stable. And so as we hit the summer, who's to say that the virus just doesn't become sort of more seasonal and start to kind of die down on its own? But then if that's the case, do we then worry about a second spike in the fall? So there's just so many unanswered questions that we really need to see how this plays out, continue working towards a vaccine, and just mitigate whatever we can with regards to its spread and its severity until we can get those measures in place. And to that, I just defer to the experts.
Well said. Spoken like a true educated guesser. It sounded good, and I was into it.
I have been educated guessing my way through most things since about the third grade. So,
including the mathletes in high school, which you were a part of.
Including the mathletes, which I was a part of.
I love
it. Not to sleep on the Scholastic Bowl, though. You can't. That's just as important.
I love it. Are there certain charities that you think I'm asking you all kinds of questions of things I just want to know. Are there certain charities that you recommend people check out in terms of online volunteering or perhaps donating if they can afford it? Is there anyone that's working closely with the medical systems that you've seen and been like, that's a group that's doing something great?
So, you know, off the top of my head, I can't point to any one thing. I know there was something that was trending in terms of raising funding for New York not too long ago. I think just about any website that you go on now has a little banner that says learn more information about COVID-19. And I'm sure there's probably links to many great and wonderful resources to donate there if you're so inclined. I know personally the Red Cross does great work, and so do Doctors Without Borders, but I can't speak to what specifically they're doing in light of the current crisis that we're kind of dealing with today.
Great. Yeah, I would be curious to know too, Doctors Without Borders. Fantastic. Well, that's super helpful. Are you up for a little rapid fire round of your favorite things you're doing in quarantine? And if you don't like it, we can take it out. Okay, great.
Bonus round. Bring it on.
Okay, great. Favorite show you're watching in quarantine?
Ooh, I actually started rewatching Community. And while there's some of it that has not aged particularly well, seeing as the show started in 2009, I absolutely love that show. It's one of my favorites.
Love it. Favorite snack you're having in quarantine? Not meal, but snack.
Favorite snack? So my girlfriend bought me this protein cookie butter that is absolutely, it's like a cookies and cream cookie butter powder that I mix in with some Greek yogurt and I crush in some Oreos. Oh my God, it's amazing.
Wow, this sounds delicious. Favorite brand of wine you have been drinking in quarantine, if at all?
Favorite brand of wine? I actually have not had any wine in quarantine.
Wow, you're amazing.
I know. I don't know why you'd think I would, even with just dinner or something, but no, I actually have been staying away from alcohol almost entirely.
It's almost like you're risking your life and saving people's lives and trying not to alter the substances within your brain and body to do good for the better and for our world almost, or something.
Almost sounds like that, doesn't it?
Almost. I'm about to eat dinner because I'm asking you all about food.
I just don't want to come out with the quarantine 15. I think that's what I'm mostly afraid of.
I'm definitely at least quarantine 5 right now, and I'm cool with that. So,
there is no judgment whatsoever. Everybody that's dealing with this quarantine in their own way is doing that, and that is totally understandable.
Absolutely. So, on that note, quarantine meal of choice.
Quarantine meal of choice got to be the pizza. I love pizza.
Great.
I'm a pizza guy.
Quarantine song of choice.
Quarantine song? Ooh. You know, I'm going to go with Hey Jude, just because me and some of my co-workers have actually worked on creating this stitch together, multiple people performing instruments and vocals to create a cover of Hey Jude. So I'm going to go with that.
Wait, that sounds amazing. You're going to make a cover like... As medical professionals, I would definitely watch that.
Yeah, we are all recording kind of individually, and then one of us in a former life used to mix his own music, and so he's working on putting it all together.
Doctors really do everything, don't they?
We do something.
Quarantine, what was I going to ask? Oh, quarantine chore of choice. Which chore do you hate the least around the house?
Do I hate the least? I was going to say procrastinating because that's what I've been doing most of, but I'm going to go with laundry. Obviously I've been doing a lot more laundry, a lot more frequently when I bring my street clothes kind of back from the hospital. So that has been sort of the bane of my existence last month.
Quarantine podcast of choice. If you have time to listen to podcasts in all of your spare time when you're not saving lives.
Can I say this one? Is that allowed?
Yes. Thank you. Let's celebrate that moment. Yes.
Of course. I do have a close runner up.
Okay.
The other two that I've been listening to. One is to keep me sharp. It's the Internet Book of Critical Care. That is my sort of knowledge justification. And then Zach Braff and Donald Faison recently came up with this podcast where they're rewatching episodes of Scrubs and just kind of talking about it as they go through it. And I think that is a wonderful podcast as well.
Gosh, celebrities they can do anything. It could just be like celebrities eating cheese and hanging out and people would be like,
and you know
yes.
what? I would watch that.
Right.
I would watch it.
Right.
It's like when Jerry Seinfeld decided he just wanted to get coffee with some of his friends. And he's like, I'm going to film this. And you know what? He was right. I'll watch it.
He absolutely was. Good for him. Okay, great. Well, that's that section. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I'm thinking out loud that I would want to ask you. Oh, you had said some interesting things in a previous Zoom call about your views on how this may have started from a political standpoint. Do you care to speak to that? I thought it was very intelligent and interesting, if you're open to sharing.
I mean, I wouldn't say political necessarily. I think it's, you can't really necessarily discuss what the country has gone through in terms of its preparedness without acknowledging sort of the slow to respond nature of the federal government, unfortunately. And I think, you know, regardless of your political ideology, this isn't to point fingers at anybody. It just seemed like we were very slow to respond, and it was very sort of too little too late-ish when we did. And we're finally starting to get things ramped up and getting things going. But it's been difficult. I mean, you see states competing against other states for protective equipment and things that are being deferred to the open market. And it's tough because it feels like this national emergency that's almost being treated piecemeal on a state-by-state basis. And philosophically, if that's what you believe the role of federal government to be, you know, more power to you. And I think that's understandable. It's just a little unfortunate to see sort of how other countries have responded and been able to sort of mitigate their curve. Meanwhile, the steepness of ours kind of just kept climbing and climbing up until really just about last week.
Yes, well said. It's fascinating. Do you think if this should happen again, the United States would be more well-equipped moving forward for the next pandemic? Or do you think it's something that is going to be, well, I'm going to ask that later, but you get it.
Yeah, I think we're probably going to have to do a lot of soul searching as a country. You know, as it currently stands, a lot of our health insurance is tied to employment. And if you're not employed, what happens to your health insurance, especially if jobless claims are skyrocketing the way that they did last month? And so I think as a country, we need to kind of sit down and rework our healthcare system to make sure that it's working for the majority of us. And, you know, we had sort of provisions in place before. We had a pandemic task force that existed. We had a well-funded CDC. We even had quote unquote boots on the ground in China, ready to sort of look into what's going on with these sort of novel viruses as they develop and risk for zoonotic exposures and such. And I think making sure that we just keep those funded and re-implement them to, you know, have them on call for when we may need them, if we need them in the future, would go a long way. It's sort of like, you know, when there's a fire in your house, that's not the time that you want the government to be sending out job applications for firemen. You want them to already have the firemen ready and waiting to respond to the fire. I think that's probably the best analogy that I can come up with.
Oh, yeah. I like that. I like fires in my house. I like that. No, that sounded weird. But no, I like what you're saying. I agree. And I find that in people's day-to-day lives, that's something that comes up a lot for me. It also, I know we live in different places and are in different worlds, but just being in LA for most of my adult life at this point and for the foreseeable future, you know, I interact with a lot of people in entertainment, and there's a lot of wonderful people, but there's also people that are more centered around themselves and their careers. And I just find that people tend to really care about what they are doing and not really thinking of other people. And I almost can't fault them, because I do think Americans as a whole are more self-centered, and, you know, we don't care for our elders the same way as other countries. We don't put pride on volunteering the same way other cultures do. So do you think it's more of a nationalist issue as opposed to a state by state issue?
I mean, I think there's going to be pockets of people like that anywhere you go.
Right.
You can probably make the argument that, you know, is it worse in some areas of the country? Is it worse in this country as a whole? I'll leave that up to the psychologists and the sociologists. I will say, you know, it's very disheartening to see things like the recent protests, kind of specifically, not even necessarily because the country, they want the country opened again, but just almost for the sake of protesting. I mean, if you don't have to go too far to see what happened in Colorado, was it just yesterday or the day before, with these protesters physically blocking ambulances from bringing patients to the hospital? Yeah, it's just one of those things that you really hate to see. It really is. It hurts even more to know, you know, what some of my colleagues are doing, putting their lives on the line, going into work every single day. And for the most part, I can tell you that the warmth and reception that I've gotten from so many people has just been incredible, and the support that I felt has been great. But you see things like that, and it's just incredibly disheartening. And that's really all that I guess I can sort of say about that. But at the end of the day, like I said, I think as a people, as a country, we really need to do a lot of soul searching once things kind of start to return to normal.
I agree. And I think that's something that people can take a piece of, that's something that people can do on an individual basis. And I hope that it occurs on a collective basis, but I do think it can start even just with you at home for those people who just feel helpless right now. You know, I've felt that way, but like, what can each person do from home? You can journal, you can talk out loud, you can talk to a friend or family member, you can talk to yourself, but figuring out what you want to stand for and what differences you want to make, you know, in 2021, I think is something people can do and take their own lives seriously and figure out what matters to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we really are all in this together. And I don't think there's anything that can point that out better than a pandemic that really doesn't care who you are. It's going to affect you. It's indiscriminate. You know, it's literally like Thanos from the Avengers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point about how it doesn't care who you are. It's, you know, all the money in the world can't prevent you from breathing in or touching or inhaling a germ or a virus. And it is very interesting how it is played out, and we will see what happens. But meanwhile, we appreciate people like you who are going to work, doing the right thing, being a good person, talking about it on a podcast. Basically, we should all just turn into you, and I think we'll solve a lot of the world's problems.
That is probably the nicest thing anybody has ever said to me.
And no one will know who you are since we're not saying your name. But you know what? You're cool. That's what they'll take away. They'll be like, that guy's cool. We like him. And one day when you're a famous doctor person, you can be like, my first podcast so many years ago, I didn't even say my name. When you go into work, what are your hours typically?
So it depends on the day. I mean, typically a shift can from 12 to 16 hours. And then we take call for 24 plus 4, 28 hours.
Wow.
A month. Yeah.
That's a lot of hours. And a 24-hour shift, I cannot imagine. Is that common in what you do? I guess. I mean, I feel like doctors.
Yeah, it's common. It's very specialty specific as well. So back in the day, they even used to do up to 72 hours straight of just you're in the hospital for 72 straight hours. Kind of sleep when you can, eat when you can. And now they've shortened that to 24. With about 4 extra hours in there for patient care transition. So every once in a while, we get a 28-hour shift.
Wow, that is absolutely fascinating. I assume they shortened it from 72 probably because, you know, how can you do your best work when it's hour 71?
Yeah, you know, you really can't. I mean, you hit hour, like, 18, and you're already kind of exhausted. You try to, like, lay down for a minute, but then, you know, you're the one responsible for covering and helping out with most of the emergencies that pop up in the hospital. So there's always backup. There's always help. There's always a number of people there as well. But those shifts can take their toll.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for what you do. That's incredible. I think that pretty much wraps it up. This was all very helpful information to hear. I mean, if there's anything else that you would like to say, if you have any last resonating thoughts and words, but I feel like I have a lot that I can edit down and together. So this was great.
No, absolutely. Thanks. And thanks for having me. Obviously, stay safe, stay sane, stay happy.
Bloopers, 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 bloopers. One day when you're a famous doctor person, you can be like, my first podcast so many years ago, I didn't even say my name. Anonymity. I'm going to take this part out.
Anemone?
Now I'm a Finding Nemo character.
It happens to the best of us.
It happens to the best of us.
I mean, back in the day, they used to do 72 straight hours where you couldn't leave the hospital, and now it's kind of gotten short.
Right, okay. There's a weird sound. We're going to pretend that didn't happen. Will you say that one more time? What you were saying about 72?